Welcome to History in a Year, America's first 250 years.
Join us every single day as we journey from the Revolution of 1776 to the 250th anniversary of the United States.
You can find every episode and join the discussion at pointedwords.com. I'm Stephen.
And I'm Leah.
It is January 18th. Welcome to episode 18. Yesterday, we watched the heartbreaking treason of Benedict Arnold in the North. But while Washington was dealing with spies on the Hudson, the war was actually being decided in the swamps of South Carolina.
By late 1780, the situation in the South was catastrophic. The British had captured Charleston. They had destroyed the only American army at the Battle of Camden. General Cornwallis was sitting in Charlotte, North Carolina, looking at a map, convinced that the rebellion was effectively over.
He was preparing to march north into Virginia to finish the job. But Cornwallis had a blind spot. He controlled the ground his soldiers stood on, but he didn't control the people.
And in the South, the war had turned into something much darker than in the North. It wasn't just armies fighting armies anymore. It was a vicious civil war.
This is something we often forget about the Revolution. In the Carolinas, it was neighbor against neighbor. If you were a patriot, your loyalist neighbor might burn your barn, steal your cattle, or hang you from a tree. And the patriots did the exact same thing in return. It was bloody, it was personal, and it was chaotic.
And in this chaos, the British Army found itself fighting ghosts. They were fighting men who didn't wear uniforms, didn't stand in lines, and didn't fight fair.
The most famous of these ghosts was Francis Marion.
Marion is such a fascinating character because he doesn't fit the mold of a superhero. He wasn't young and dashing like Alexander Hamilton. He was a 48-year-old bachelor planter. He was small, moody, and he walked with a permanent limp because of a badly set broken ankle.
He had actually escaped capture at Charleston because of that ankle. He had been at a dinner party, and to avoid drinking too much wine, he jumped out of a second-story window and broke his leg. He was sent home before the city fell. That jump saved his career.
While he recovered in the swamps, he gathered a band of partisans. These weren't professional soldiers. They were farmers, free blacks, and teenage boys. They rode their own farm horses and carried their own rifles. They were ragtag, hungry, and looked more like bandits than soldiers.
They operated in the cypress swamps of the PD and Santee Rivers. If you've never been there, these swamps are terrifying places, thick with Spanish moss, venomous snakes, alligators, and stifling heat.
The British regulars, in their heavy wool red coats, couldn't function there. They got lost. They got sick. They were terrified of what was lurking in the water.
But Marion used the swamps as a fortress. He knew every path. He would strike British supply lines at midnight, capture wagons of ammunition, and then vanish back into the mist before the sun came up.
There is a famous legend that sums up Marion perfectly. It's called the Sweet Potato Dinner.
A British officer came to Marion's camp under a flag of truce to discuss a prisoner exchange. He was blindfolded and led through the swamp. When the blindfold was taken off, he was shocked by what he saw.
He expected a military camp with tents and order. Instead, he saw men sleeping on the muddy ground, cleaning rusty rifles.
Marion invited the officer to dinner. The officer looked around for a table or plates. Instead, one of Marion's men pulled a pile of roasted sweet potatoes out of the ashes of a fire. Marion wiped the ash off a potato, broke it in half, and handed it to the officer on a piece of tree bark.
That was it. That was dinner. Water and roots.
The British officer reportedly went back to his commander and resigned his commission. He said, "I have seen an American general and his officers without pay and almost without clothes, living on roots and drinking water, and all for liberty. What chance have we against such men?"
The British cavalry commander, Banastre Tarleton, known as the Butcher, hated Marion. He once chased him for 26 miles through the swamps.
Finally, Tarleton stopped his horse, exhausted, and shouted to his men, "Come on, boys! Let us go back and find the gamecock." That was another general, Thomas Sumter. But as for this old fox, the devil himself could not catch him.
And the name stuck. The Swamp Fox.
Marion kept the British distracted. He forced Cornwallis to divert thousands of troops just to protect his supply lines. But while Marion was annoying the British in the Low Country, a much bigger threat was gathering in the West.
This brings us to one of the most dramatic stories of the entire war, the story of the Overmountain Men.
Cornwallis had a brilliant but arrogant subordinate named Major Patrick Ferguson. Ferguson was the inspector of militia. He was actually a famous marksman. He had invented a breech-loading rifle that could fire much faster than a standard musket.
Ferguson was given the job of securing the left flank of the British Army. That meant patrolling the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains to protect Cornwallis from the west.
Ferguson did his job well. He rallied thousands of American loyalists to fight for the king. But then, he made a fatal error. He looked up at the Blue Ridge Mountains and decided to threaten the settlers living on the other side.
These were the settlers in what is today East Tennessee, places like the Watauga and Holston settlements. They were mostly Scots-Irish Presbyterians. They were tough, independent people, living on the absolute edge of the frontier. They just wanted to be left alone.
Ferguson sent a prisoner across the mountains with a verbal message. He warned them that if they didn't desist from their opposition to British arms, he would, quote, march his army over the mountains, hang their leaders, and lay their country waste with fire and sword.
You do not tell a Scots-Irish frontiersman that you are going to burn his home.
Instead of being scared, they got mad. Really mad. Leaders like Isaac Shelby and John Sevier sent out the call.
On September 25, 1780, over 1,000 men gathered at a place called Sycamore Shoals. It must have been an incredible sight. They had no uniforms. They wore hunting shirts made of buckskin. They carried long, Deckard rifles, hunting weapons that were deadly accurate at long range.
They had no supply wagons. Each man carried a bag of ground corn mixed with maple sugar. That was their food. And they had no orders from Congress or George Washington. They were doing this on their own.
A minister, Reverend Samuel Doak, gave them a sermon before they left. He invoked the Bible, shouting, "The sword of the Lord and of Gideon!" The men roared back. It felt like a crusade.
They marched over the mountains. It snowed on the peaks. They covered 330 miles in 2 weeks, tracking Ferguson like they were hunting a bear.
Ferguson heard they were coming. He started to retreat toward Cornwallis's main army. But he moved too slowly. He stopped at a rocky ridge near the border of North and South Carolina, called King's Mountain.
It's a flat-topped ridge, shaped like a footprint. Ferguson camped on top. He felt invincible. He famously shouted that he was king of the mountain, and that God Almighty himself could not drive him from it.
He had about 1,100 men with him, and here is a crucial detail. Every single man on that mountain, on both sides, was an American. The only British person there was Major Ferguson himself. This was Americans fighting Americans.
On the afternoon of October 7, 1780, the Overmountain men arrived. It had rained all morning, so the leaves were wet and quiet. They didn't stop to rest. They surrounded the base of the mountain.
They fought Indian style. They didn't stand in lines. They hid behind trees and rocks, moving up the slope, firing those deadly accurate rifles.
Ferguson blew a silver whistle to direct his troops. He ordered them to launch bayonet charges. Now, in a normal battle, a bayonet charge is terrifying. But here, the terrain worked against him.
When the Loyalists charged down the hill with bayonets, the Overmountain men would just run back, hide behind trees, and shoot the Loyalists in the back as they tried to climb back up to the summit.
They did this 3 times. It was a shrinking ring of fire. As they climbed higher, the Americans started shouting their own battle cry, "Tarleton's quarter!"
Remember that? Tarleton's quarter. It meant no mercy. They were remembering the massacre at the Waxhaws earlier that year, where Americans had been butchered while surrendering. They were out for blood.
Ferguson was desperate. He was riding back and forth on his white horse, blowing his silver whistle. He was wearing a checkered hunting shirt over his uniform, which made him an easy target.
Suddenly, a volley of bullets hit him. He was shot at least 7 times simultaneously. One bullet hit his head. His foot got caught in the stirrup, and his horse dragged him down the mountain. He died instantly.
With their leader dead, the Loyalists tried to surrender. They waved white flags. But the Overmountain men were filled with rage. They kept firing for several minutes, shouting, "Give them Tarleton's quarter!"
Finally, the officers, Isaac Shelby and William Campbell, managed to regain control. They literally had to beat their own men with swords to stop the shooting. But the damage was done.
The battle lasted only 65 minutes. But in that hour, Ferguson's entire force was destroyed. 290 killed, 163 wounded, and 668 captured.
The American losses? Only 28 killed and 60 wounded.
It was a catastrophe for the British. Ferguson was Cornwallis's left arm, and it had just been chopped off.
Thomas Jefferson later said that the Battle of King's Mountain was the turn of the tide of success.
And he was right. Cornwallis was shocked. He realized the backcountry wasn't filled with loyalists waiting to help him. It was filled with angry frontiersmen waiting to kill him.
He abandoned his invasion of North Carolina. He retreated back into South Carolina to wait out the winter. The momentum of the war had completely shifted.
And this victory bought George Washington time. Time to finally convince Congress to send a real general to the South, a man who could harness the power of the Swamp Fox and the Overmountain Men.
That man was Nathanael Greene, and he was about to change the way the war was fought.
Join us tomorrow for Episode 19. General Nathanael Greene takes command and decides to break the rules of warfare. We witness the tactical masterpiece at the Battle of Cowpens, where the old wagoner Daniel Morgan sets a trap that destroys the British Army.
I'm Leah.
And I'm Stephen. You can find every episode at pointedwords.com, and this is our story.